Greetings, this is Tyler McPheeters with your News Gazette, dated Friday, October 17th, 2025. We'll begin today's reading with the front page, an article headlined, Son's Autism Put to Music, Couple's Passion Project Set to Take Stage. Story by Jennifer Bailey, out of Danville. They looked and looked, but Champagne Theater buffs Cameron and A.J. Cornell couldn't find their own family dynamic, raising a son with autism, represented in any shows. So they decided to write one. Really, the heart of the story is not the focus on the struggle. It's focusing on the joy and the love that comes about through all of that, Cameron said, of Let Me Fly, which will be presented next month at Danville Area Community College's Bremer Conference Center. Hopefully, people come away from it also seeing how the other characters also learn how to communicate with each other, AJ added, where it's not just the super obvious, learn to use a communication device, but also people who maybe we don't think of needing to learn how to communicate, also learning to communicate with each other. The show's set for 7 p.m., November 7th to the 8th, and 2 p.m. November 9th are workshop presentations, meaning they'll be stripped to the bare essentials. Actors wear black clothing instead of costumes, sets are minimalist, and few props are used. The idea of it is to be able to see how the story works and how the actors are able to tell the story on stage before putting it up for a fully staged production, AJ said. AJ said theater has been a huge part of their lives, both from being in shows themselves and being nerd fans in the audience. The couple's first date was to see a play, and on the day after they got engaged, they saw Hamilton in Chicago. As the Cornells became parents and their son, Josiah, was diagnosed with autism, they discovered there weren't stories that reflected his life or family's experiences. It started really just kind of as this passion project that we wanted to do of what would this look like, AJ said. He wrote a few songs. We started talking about what the plot would look like. They gradually created the musical, melding their life experiences with their passion for theater. As they wrote it, interest grew in making Let Me Fly public after several readings at the Station Theater in Urbana. The plot changed in between the first and second readings, based on feedback, and the cast of three grew to seven. They added and took away scenes and songs, and eventually wound up renaming the musical altogether after one of the songs. After a third draft, they realized they needed to take the next steps to staging it, put it up on its feet, and see how a crowd responds. That's when they approached friends Jordan and Katie Ritchie, both members of the Danville Light Orchestra Musical Theater Board, whom Cameron had worked with on a couple of other shows, about partnering up. Katie came on board as stage manager and producer for Let Me Fly, and Jordan stepped into the main role, the adult Sam, in the Cornells musical. The musical features 17 songs, pared down from 40, with Sam telling his story about growing up learning how to communicate and connect. As a child, Sam was nonverbal but learned to communicate with an AAC, augmentive and alternative communication device. The musical, about 2 hours in length with an intermission, includes a few meltdowns and self-injurious behavior, which puts pressure on the whole family, Cameron said. Audiences should know that strong language is used, akin to a PG-13 rating. The show is not the Cornells' personal story, they said, but it's the world they live in. Another adoption. AJ, who grew up in Urbana, and Cameron, who's from down south, moved back to Champaign about 2 years ago after spending six in Chicago. They met while in the theater at a small Bible college in Minnesota, got married right after finishing up, and moved back to Illinois for work. AJ is a case manager at Cunningham Children's Home. Cameron is in nursing school at Parkland College. Back in Chicago, they adopted their first child, Josiah, now six, who'd had a really tough journey, Cameron said. He ended up having a trach and was on a ventilator at our home for a few years, and we were his caregivers and learned how to operate a feeding pump and the ventilator and how to do trach changes and all of that. We're his nurses. As if their lives weren't happily busy enough, a month ago they received a text from the Chicago Adoption Agency that brought Josiah into their lives. Another family was looking to adopt a special needs child who had a tough, rough road ahead, one that included open-heart surgery. Would the Cornells be willing to mentor the couple, they were asked, and responded with a quick yes. Then, in the same text exchange, the social worker who helped with Josiah's adoption asked if they were thinking of adopting again. They said they were, but nothing came of the exchange. Then the adoption agency reached back out with more news. The couple the Cornells had agreed to mentor decided they weren't ready for a complex adoption and backed out. Would the Cornells consider adopting this child too? The child needs a forever home now, AJ said, so of course they'd figure out how to make it work. Part of that involves the financials of adoption, which add up to about $8,000. Family and friends have put together a fundraiser to help. It's set for 5 p.m. Sunday at First Presbyterian Church of Urbana. Given their passion for musical theater, that's the theme of Sunday's event, which Cameron said will include a crazy good lineup of local performers. It's going to be a lot of fun, he said, with a lineup of mostly Broadway tunes, with a few others woven in. It is our joy to adopt our new son, and we know that others want to support that, and so we're providing an opportunity for them to do so, Cameron said. He's a cutie. The Cornells have met 3-month-old Theodore, who was born almost 3 months early but is projected to have good outcomes following needed open-heart surgery. He's a cutie, Cameron said, pulling out his phone like a proud dad to show a photo. Thinking about the heart of why they wrote Let Me Fly, Cameron told the story of another family with 2 autistic children who came to That might have been muted. Sorry about that. He's a cutie. The Cornells have met 3-month-old Theodore, who was born almost 3 months early but is projected to have good outcomes following needed open-heart surgery. He's a cutie, Cameron said, pulling out his phone like a proud dad to show a photo. Thinking about the heart of why they wrote Let Me Fly, Cameron told the story of another family with 2 autistic children who came to a second reading of their show. The parents wept afterwards and shared that it was powerful seeing their lives represented. They were so impacted. It was such a sweet moment to see, Cameron said. They felt seen. The next front page story is Champaign County Drug Court. When you're clean, good things happen. Latest graduates excited to move on to new sober chapter. Story by Luke Taylor, out of Urbana. Monday marks the next graduation ceremony for Champaign County Drug Court, when a new class of individuals will celebrate their journeys in overcoming addiction. The program offers people facing criminal charges a chance to see their sentences reduced if they're willing to undergo an intense program to fight the addiction that they face. A new group graduates every 6 months. Here are just 2 members of this fall's class. Randy Kozad. For Kozad, Monday will be her first time graduating from anything, and she's so ready to walk across that stage. It's kind of surreal, you know. My mom's going to be there. It's kind of a big step for me, Kozad said. When she started drug court, she didn't have a job, she didn't have money, and she didn't have a support system. Now she's been employed long enough to build up funds in a savings account for the first time in her life. Job hunting was very hard, Kozad said, but some of the other necessary steps, like finding new friends, were easier than she might have expected. I can adapt well to change because in my addiction, I would just bounce from place to place, Kozad said. So change sometimes can be overwhelming or difficult, but I think I did pretty well for the most part. Although I was overwhelmed at times, I just kept pushing. Her circumstances have changed dramatically, and she now has support through Narcotics Anonymous and the WIN recovery program alongside drug court. The structure of those programs has been very helpful to her, Kozad said. She also said that she feels dramatically different as she turns her life around. I used to have cravings or visions, like visions of me being high and stuff like that, she said. I haven't had that in months. Cosette has reconnected with one of her children through this process and said she is looking forward to connecting with the rest now that she is supposed to have visitation rites in the near future. The hardest part of all of this was probably fighting my own thoughts, she said. At times, I just wanted to give up, but I knew I should stay and I should keep fighting. I'm getting to see my kids, and that's worth it. Sean Lehman. Lehman dropped out of drug court in his first attempt, but he ended up returning and turning himself in. He knew he had to make a change. I was out in the streets using heroin and crack, and I had enough, and I turned myself in, Lehman said. And here I am with my own place and job and 15 months clean, graduating drug court. It was rock bottom, he said, where all he had was the clothes on his back, and he realized he just couldn't live like that. He had been 8 months into the program when he ran, and he had to completely restart and do it a second time. His family had withdrawn financial support, though Lehman said they still supported him in other ways and were showing him tough love, and he was facing prison time if he didn't go through the program. I had to change my old friends that I used to live with, he said. I had to live in a recovery home. That helped. And landed a job helped a lot, because it got me in a routine in life and helped me save money. Drug court was tough at first, with classes almost every single day and no family in the immediate area to help drive him around. Lehman now describes the program as a full-time job, but he pushed through. Now, he thinks he might move back home to take care of his parents and seek out a career job to move into in the future. One of the most important lessons he took away from the program was simple. Make the right choices. For him, that means intentionally avoiding situations that would encourage him to use. It gets easier in the time when you keep attending and keep staying clean and keep doing the right thing and don't give up, Lehman said. When you're clean, good things happen. Sean Lehman is set to graduate from Champaign County's drug court program on Monday. The next story on the front page is Geis Memorial Stadium. Petition started to revert name. Story by Jana Wiersema, out of Champaign. A month after Memorial Stadium was renamed following a $100 million donation from University of Illinois alumnus and philanthropist Larry Geis, some are calling for Geis Memorial Stadium to return to its original name. The name Memorial Stadium is not just a label, it is a tribute, a recognition of brave sacrifices, and a testament to our history and values. 1969 alumna Gwen French wrote in an online petition at ipetitions.com. This is why it is deeply concerning and personal to us to preserve its original name without the addition of any commercialization or other names that would detract from its profound meaning. French is part of the Memorial Stadium Society, a loosely organized group of concerned individuals that has also sent letters to several newspapers, radio stations, and broadcasters throughout the state and the country. They've also taken out ads on the subject. I feel like the history of it, Memorial Stadium, we expect to last another 100 years, French told the News Gazette. And to have that name change even now it feels wrong. The stadium, which celebrated its centennial last year, was originally dedicated to the 189 students and alumni who died in World War I. In 2002, the names of alumni, students, faculty, and staff killed in every conflict since were added to the limestone columns along the top of the stadium. The U of I's Division of Intercollegiate Athletics announced in September that the Geis surname would be added to the stadium, both in recognition of Geis' gift, the largest in DIA history, and his late father, Larry Geis Sr. Geis said he was making the donation in memory of his dad, an Army veteran. It's the second nine-figure gift the Chicago entrepreneur and wife Beth have made to their alma mater following a $150 million pledge to what's now known as the Geis College of Business. This one is designated for improving and preserving the stadium. The decision to rename the facility has attracted one well-read guest commentary by Urbana Marine veteran Ray Elliott, several letters to the editor, and scores of social media comments from individuals like French, want to see the old name restored. This has absolutely nothing to do with the wonderful benefactor Larry Geis's donation to the university, French said. We're very grateful for that. That's not an issue at all. The people are just wanting to maintain the name of Memorial Stadium. When asked for comment, Geis referred the News Gazette to the remarks made by both himself and the university during the renaming announcement. I am proud that my family, most notably my father, himself a veteran of the United States Army, is now associated with this critically important memorial, and I am glad that my support can ensure that the Memorial Stadium name and, more importantly, the facility's timeless purpose will be protected and amplified during the stadium's next 100 years, Geis added. By forming this partnership with the university, we have ensured that the stadium continues to be a place where the sacrifices of our nation's fallen soldiers will never be forgotten. DIA officials likewise said that many questions were answered in the initial press conferences and announcements. The department also offered the following statement to the News Gazette. We acknowledge the highly personal connection that many have to our football stadium. As we made clear in the communications surrounding the original announcement, the university has the utmost respect and appreciation for the history and purpose of our stadium, feelings shared by Illinois alumnus Larry Geis, who has chosen to invest in protecting and amplifying the stadium's proud legacy for generations to come. The response to Mr. Geis' gift has been overwhelmingly positive. People have been grateful for his remarkable generosity and commitment to advancing the stadium's mission, while also ensuring that the Memorial Stadium name remains central to the building's identity. In addition to contacting media outlets, the Memorial Stadium Society also planned to reach out to the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs Office of the Inspector General about the renaming, though the agency indicated to the News Gazette that the matter is not within its purview. The Department of Veterans Affairs Office of Inspector General does not have a comment, said Public Affairs Specialist Amanda Simmons. Memorial Stadium is not a Veterans Affairs facility, therefore we have no oversight. Turning now to national and world news. In international relations, Venezuela floated plan for Maduro to give up power, but U.S. rejected it. Out of Washington and the AP. Venezuelan government officials have floated a plan in which President Nicolas Maduro would eventually leave office, a bid aimed at easing mounting U.S. pressure on the government in Caracas, according to a former Trump administration official. The proposal, which was rejected by the White House, calls for Maduro to step down from power in 3 years and hand over authority to his vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, who would complete Maduro's current 6-year term that runs until January 2031, according to the official who was briefed on the plan but was not authorized to comment publicly on the matter and spoke on the condition of anonymity. Rodriguez would not run for re-election under the plan, the official said, adding the White House had rejected the proposal because it continues to question the legitimacy of Maduro's rule and accuse him of overseeing a narco-terrorist state. The revelation of Maduro's attempts to offer a plan to slowly ease himself out of power comes amid growing unease in the Venezuelan leader's government that President Donald Trump could order military action to try to oust him. Aspects of the Venezuelan effort were first reported by the Miami Herald earlier Thursday. The White House did not respond to a request for comment. Speaking at a televised event Thursday, Maduro ridiculed reports that Rodriguez would be part of a plan to replace him as an attempt to divide our people. He also mocked Trump's confirmation Wednesday that the U.S. president had authorized the CIA to operate in Venezuela. Can anyone believe the CIA hasn't been operating in Venezuela for the past 60 years, Maduro said. Rodriguez described the alleged plan for Maduro to step down as fake news Thursday. Fake, Rodriguez wrote in English on her Telegram account. More media that add to the garbage dump of the psychological war against the Venezuelan people. She added that Venezuela's leadership is united. Since early September, the U.S. military has carried out a series of strikes on alleged drug smuggling vessels in the Caribbean Sea, including against at least 4 boats that originated from Venezuela. Those strikes followed Trump deploying three Aegis-guided missile destroyers to the waters off Venezuela as part of what the administration has framed as an effort to combat threats from Latin American drug cartels. The next story in national and world news. Mideast conflict. Chief of staff of Yemen Houthi rebels military dies from wounds suffered in Israeli airstrike. Out of Dubai in the United Arab Emirates and the AP. An Israeli airstrike targeting the top leaders of Yemen's Houthi rebels in August killed the chief of staff of its military, officials said Thursday, further escalating tensions between the group and Israel, even as a ceasefire holds in the Gaza Strip. The Houthis have acknowledged the killing of Major General Muhammad Abdul Karim al-Ghamari, who had been sanctioned by the United Nations over his role in the country's decade-long war. Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz said al-Ghamari died of wounds he suffered in the attack and had joined his fellow members of the Axis of Evil in the depths of hell. Katz referred to the strike as the Strike of the Firstborn, likely a reference to a series of strikes Israel conducted on August 28th. That attack killed Houthi Prime Minister Ahmed al-Rahawi and others. However, analysts suggested al-Ghamari may have been wounded in a different attack targeting the secretive group. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu also acknowledged Israel killing al-Ghamari. Another chief of staff in the line of terror chiefs who aimed to harm us was eliminated, Netanyahu said. We will reach all of them. In a statement carried by the Houthi-controlled SABA news agency, the militants said al-Ghamari had been killed alongside his 13-year-old son Hussein and several of his companions. It did not elaborate on the date of the strike, nor did it identify the others killed in the strike. Alaska Typhoon Halong. Officials airlift evacuees to safety after villages ruined. Story out of Juneau, Alaska, and the AP. Officials in Alaska rushed Tuesday to evacuate and find housing for people from tiny coastal villages devastated by the remnants of Typhoon Halong. But the remote location and severe damage are limiting their options as they race against other impending storms and the onset of winter. High winds and surging waters battered low-lying, isolated Alaska Native communities along the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta in southwest Alaska, nearly 500 miles from Anchorage over the weekend. The Coast Guard plucked 24 people from their homes after the structures floated out to sea in high water. Three people were missing or dead, and hundreds of people were staying in school shelters, including one with no working toilets, officials said. The system followed a storm that struck parts of western Alaska days earlier. Across the region, more than 1,500 people were displaced. Dozens had been flown to a shelter set up in the National Guard Armory in the regional hub city of Bethel, a community of 6,000 people. And officials are considering flying evacuees to longer-term shelter or emergency housing in Fairbanks and Anchorage as they run out of room there. Fuel storage depots intended to support communities in the region had apparently been damaged, threatening pollution that could harm the fish and game the Alaska Native residents rely on for subsistence. Some people in the area may have lost freezers full of food, such as salmon and moose, intended to get them through the winter. The hardest hit communities included Kipnuk, population 715, and Quillongunk, population 380. They are off the state's main road system and reachable this time of year only by water or by air. It's catastrophic in Kipnuk. Let's not paint any other picture, Mark Roberts, incident commander for the State Emergency Management Division, told a news conference Tuesday. We are doing everything we can to continue to support that community, but it is as bad as you can think. Among those awaiting evacuation to Bethel on Tuesday was Brea Paul of Quillongunk, who said in a text message that she had seen about 20 homes floating away through the moonlight on Saturday night. Some houses would blink their phone lights at us like they were asking for help, but we couldn't even do anything, she wrote. The following morning, she recorded video of a house submerged nearly to its roof line as it floated past her home. Paul and her neighbors had a long meeting in the local schoolhouse gym on Monday night, singing songs of praises as they tried to figure out what to do next, she said. Neither she nor most anyone else knows where they will end up. It's so heartbreaking saying goodbye to our community members, not knowing when we'd get to see each other, she said. One woman was found dead in Quillingock, and authorities on Monday night called off the search for two men after their home floated away. In Quillingonk, the school was the only facility with full power, but it had no working toilet, and 400 people stayed there Monday night. Workers are trying to fix the bathrooms. A situation report from the State Emergency Operations Center on Tuesday noted that honey buckets are being used. A preliminary assessment showed every home in the village was damaged by the storm, with about 36 having drifted from their foundations, the emergency management office said. Power systems flooded in Napakiak, and severe erosion was reported in Tuksuk Bay. In Nightmute, officials said, fuel drums were reported floating in the community, and there was a scent of fuel in the air and a sheen on the water. Officials activated members of the National Guard to help with the emergency response, and crews were trying to take advantage of any breaks in the weather to fly in food, water, generators, and communication equipment. We have a few moments to fit in some of our daybook almanac. There are 75 days left in the year. Some notable birthdays. Singer Gary Puckett is 83. Actor, musician Michael McKean is 78. Astronaut Mae Jemison is 69. Country singer Alan Jackson is 67. Film director Rob Marshall is 65. Animator-filmmaker Mike Judge is 63. Reggae singer Ziggy Marley is 57. Actor Wood Harris is 56. Musician Wyclef Jean is 56. Golf Hall of Famer Ernie Els is 56. And singer Chris Kirkpatrick of NSYNC is 54. In some area history, in 1925, Judge Franklin Boggs, presiding in circuit court, sounded the death knell of Sunday moving picture shows in Urbana by issuing writs of injunction closing theaters on the Sabbath. In 1975, Dennis D. Hunter, the remaining fugitive of the five convicts who escaped from the federal penitentiary in Marion, eluded police in the Rantoul area and reportedly forced a truck driver to drive him to Chicago. This, however, was not learned until after a massive manhunt involving about 150 law enforcement officers had been underway for hours southwest of Rantoul. Hunter evaded another massive search for the last 6 days near Salem, 120 miles south of Champaign. He had been serving a 5-year term at the penitentiary for kidnapping, assault on a federal officer, and escape. In 2010, speaking to a group of social workers at the Danville Public Library, the two candidates to succeed veteran state representative Bill Black, Republican of Danville, in the 104th House District, came across as near-carbon copies. We're both pro-life, we're both in favor of the Second Amendment and carry laws, we're both pretty good guys, Democrat Michael Purr, a Danville alderman, told the group. We differ on, I'm a Democrat, he's a Republican. Later, Republican Chad Hayes of Catlin said essentially the same thing. International history, today's highlight. On October 17, 1989, a magnitude 6.9 earthquake struck Northern California, killing 63 people and causing up to $10 billion worth of damage. On this date in 1777, British forces under General John Burgoyne surrendered to American troops in Saratoga, New York, in a turning point of the Revolutionary War. In 1931, mobster Al Capone was convicted in Chicago of income tax evasion. He would be sentenced to 11 years in prison, fined $50,000, and ordered to pay back taxes. Capone was released in 1939. In 1933, Albert Einstein arrived in the United States as a refugee from Nazi Germany. And we will take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the News Gazette, dated Friday, October 17th, 2025. Please stay tuned.